on VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Coming up on the program, Gregory Stockel has a story about a man who went from shining shoes in the Ivory Coast to sitting on the Italian Parliament. Brian Lynn reports on a project to digitize old advertisements for silent films. And Faith Perlow explains the difference between the similar-sounding words afflict and inflict. Later, we listen to part four of Edgar Allan Poe's story, William Wilson. But first, here is Gregory Stockel.
When Abu Bakr Soumaoro was a child in his West African home country of Ivory Coast, he cleaned people's shoes to make money. He also had a dream to go to Italy. He would cut out magazine pictures related to the country and save them in a record book. His dream came true in 1999 when he arrived in Rome, Italy's capital. He was 19 years old and shocked by the difficulties he faced in a country he had prized for so long. Sleeping rough in the streets was traumatic, especially when I realized that this was the result of a political decision that targeted the migrants, Soumaoro told Reuters. Now an Italian citizen, the 42-year-old has the chance to reshape migrant life in the country from within parliament. Last month, Soumaoro won a seat in Italy's lower house of parliament, representing the Green and Left Party. He faces a conservative government that is seeking to increase restrictions on asylum seekers. One thing I will try to do is make sure that no one ends up living in the streets like me, Soumaoro said before the opening of Parliament on October 13th. People need to be treated as human beings regardless of what passport they have, he added. The new lawmaker is the only black member of Parliament's lower house, a group of 400 representatives. I did not want to represent just one part of society. I want to make sure that everyone, both the dispossessed and those who struggle to make ends meet, can recognize themselves in what we do, he said. Soumaoro's election comes from a great many steps he took before arriving in office. They include fieldwork harvesting crops, employment at a gasoline station, sociology studies at Naples University, and writing a book. Soumaoro is restrained in discussion of his personal life. He says he has a young child and stays in touch with his family in Africa. He told Reuters that Italian politics was too personal already and said, "It is more important to talk about us and not I." Within a few years of his arrival in Italy, he became an activist helping migrants who were without official documents. He worked to improve working conditions for temporary farm laborers. Later, he established an agricultural workers' union. Soumaoro accuses the extremely conservative parties, Brothers of Italy and League Party, of making migrant policy a political issue for electoral gain. Brothers of Italy won the most votes in the elections last month. It and the League Party have promised to block migrants coming by sea from North Africa. The alliance calls their stated policy Italians First. Soumaoro says the policy is flawed. Putting Italians first is not going to pull 5.6 million Italians out of poverty. He said the lawmakers failed to understand the severity of problems faced by average families. The election winners have said they will reduce access to government assistance, known as citizens' income. The monthly payment goes to poor and unemployed people. Suma Oro argues that the program needs to be expanded, not reduced. Politicians haven't seen the coming hurricane of poverty, he said. He warned that rising energy and food prices would create growing difficulties. And he argued that a better spread of wealth would help decrease rising social tensions. He said, "The politics of happiness is real. It can be done." I'm Gregory Stockel.
Silent films established America's movie industry. But many of these films from the early 1900s no longer exist. A new project aims to capture the flavor of these movies by digitizing old advertisements for them and publishing the materials online. The idea for the project came from Chicago-based collector Dwight Cleveland. He is cooperating on the effort with a professor and students at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. Cleveland is a property developer who became interested in the silent movie advertisements, also called cards, as a high school student in the 1970s. He was introduced to some real cards by his art teacher at the time, who had a small collection. Cleveland recently told the Associated Press he fell in love with the colors, graphics, and other elements used in the movie cards. The early experience made him want to start his own collection. "It just sort of screamed out, 'Take me home,'" Cleveland said. The cards were made to be placed inside the area outside theater entrances, also known as lobbies. The cards informed filmgoers about what movies were currently playing, as well as films that would arrive next. They publicized all that early Hollywood had to offer, including comedies, love stories, and action movies. Cleveland told the AP that about 90% of all silent films have been lost. One of the main reasons for this is that the chemicals used to make many of the early films broke down over time. Many silent films were also destroyed in fires. What that means is that these lobby cards are the only tangible example that these films even existed, Cleveland said. The cards, traditionally measuring 28 by 35 centimeters, were placed in sets of eight or more. They showed a film's name, production company, actors, and more. The cards were meant to give moviegoers a preview of the films. Today, they capture the stars and storytelling methods that existed during America's silent film period, or era. At the time, Movie trailers, the brief video introductions of upcoming movies we still see in theaters today, were not common. The early lobby cards were produced using a process that mostly used black, white, and brown designs. Other colors were often added in later by hand, writes Josie Walters Johnston. She is a librarian in the Moving Image Research Center at the U.S. Library of Congress. By the 1920s, the images began to look more like pictures and included more complex design details. The cards were placed in theaters for many years, but production stopped in the late 1970s or early 1980s, Walters Johnston wrote. Cleveland has been sending examples from his personal collection to Dartmouth's Media Ecology Project. The effort is led by Mark Williams, an associate professor of film and media studies. He oversees a small group of students who remove each card from its protective covering to scan and digitize. When completed, the lobby card collection will become part of Dartmouth's Early Cinema Compendium. It is a large collection of rare and valuable elements relating to early and mostly lost American films. The compendium will be published online with financial help from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Williams said the main goal of the project is to make the material available to early movie fans and scholars alike. He added that he hopes publishing the collection will catapult new interest in the silent film era. I'm Brian Lynn.
This week on Ask a Teacher, we will answer a question from Ray in Hong Kong about the difference between two very similar sounding words, afflict and inflict. Hello, VOA Learning English. What is the difference between afflict and inflict? Thank you, Ray from Hong Kong. Thank you, Ray, for writing to us. These two words are often confused. Not only do they sound the same, especially in fast speech, but they also have very similar meanings. Both of these verbs can mean to cause harm or to bring pain to. However, their correct use depends on who or what is doing the action and who or what is affected by the action. The verb inflict takes a direct object, but that direct object is usually the harm that someone is suffering. For example, paper cuts always inflict much more pain than you expect. Here, the object of inflict is the pain from the paper cut. We often use a prepositional phrase starting with on to tell who is suffering the harm. For example, the war inflicted suffering on the people. Inflict can also mean to impose or force. His job inflicts a lot of pressure on him, as he works very long days. I do not want to inflict my bad mood on you, so I'm going to stay home. Let us move on to afflict. The verb afflict also means to cause harm to, but the direct object of afflict is often the sufferer. COVID still afflicts many at-risk populations. Waterborne diseases sometimes afflict flood survivors. If afflict is used in the passive voice, we often use the preposition with, followed by the cause of the harm. For example, she was afflicted with depression for many months before asking for help. My cat was afflicted with extreme sickness after he ate an insect. Let's review these two verbs. For inflict, someone or something inflicts harm, pain, or damage on something else. For afflict, something, like an illness, afflicts someone. In the case of the passive voice, someone is afflicted with something that causes harm, like an illness. Please let us know if these explanations have helped you, Ray. What question do you have about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Faith Perlow.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
William Wilson, Part 4.
As I ended the last part of my story, I was speaking of that terrible evening when I played cards with a young gentleman called Glendinning. We were in the room of one of my friends at Oxford University. I had just realized that the young man, weak of mind and weakened by wine, had allowed me to win from him everything he owned. I was still trying to decide what I should do when, as I said, the wide, heavy doors of the room were suddenly opened, every light in the room went out, but I had seen that a stranger had entered. He was about my own height, and he was wearing a very fine, long coat. The darkness, however, was now complete, and we could only feel that he was standing among us. Then we heard him speak in a soft, low, never-to-be-forgotten voice, which I felt deep in my heart. He said, "Gentlemen, I am here only to do my duty. You cannot know the true character of the man who has tonight taken a large amount of money from Mr. Glendinning. Please have him take off his coat, and then look in it very carefully. While he was speaking, there was not another sound in the room. As he ended, he was gone. Shall I tell what I felt? Need I say that I was afraid, that I felt the sick fear of those who are judged forever wrong? Many hands held me, lights were brought, my friends looked in my coat. In it they found all the high cards, the valuable cards needed to win in the game we had been playing. Secretly using these cards, I could have taken the money of anyone who played the game with me. Mr. Preston, in whose room we were, then said, "Mr. Wilson, this is yours." He lifted from the floor a fine, warm coat and said, "We shall not look in this to prove again what we have proved already. We have seen enough. You will understand, I hope, the need for you to leave the university. At the very least, you must leave my room, and leave it now." Down in the dust, though my spirit was, I might have tried to strike him for those words if, at that moment, I had not noticed something very surprising. My coat had cost more money than most men could spend, and it had been made especially for me. It was different, I thought, from every other coat in the world. When, therefore, Mr. Preston gave me the coat which he had picked up from the floor, I saw with terror that my own was already hanging on my arm, and that the two were alike in every way. I remembered that the strange being who had so mysteriously entered and left the room had had a coat. No one else in the room had been wearing one. I placed the coat offered by Mr. Preston over my own and left his room. The next morning I began a hurried journey away from Oxford University. I ran, but I could not escape. I went from city to city, and in each one Wilson appeared. Paris, Rome, Vienna, Berlin, Moscow. He followed me everywhere. Years passed. I went to the very ends of the earth. I ran in fear, as if running from a terrible sickness, and still he followed. Again and again I asked myself, who is he? Where did he come from? And what was his purpose? But no answer was found. And then I looked with greatest care at the methods of his watch over me. I learned little. It was noticeable, indeed, that when he appeared now, it was only to stop me in those actions from which evil might result. But what right did he have to try to control me? I also noticed that although he always wore clothes the same as mine, he no longer let me see his face. Did he think I would not know him? He destroyed my honor at Oxford. He stopped me in my plans for getting a high position in Rome, in my love in Naples, in what he called my desire for too much money in Egypt. Did he think I could fail to see that he was the William Wilson of my schoolboy days, the hated and feared William Wilson? But let me hurry to the last scene in my story. Until now I had not tried to strike back. He was honorable and wise. He could be everywhere, and he knew everything. I felt such wonder and fear of him that I believed myself to be weak and helpless. Though it made me angry, I had done as he desired. But now I wanted more and more to escape his control. As I began to grow stronger, it seemed to me that he began to grow weaker. I felt a burning hope. In my deepest thoughts, I decided that I was going to be free. It was at Rome, during the Carnival of 1835, that I went to a dance in the great house of the Duke de Broglio. I had been drinking more wine than is usual, and the room seemed very crowded and hot. I became angry as I pushed through the people. I was looking, let me not say why, I was looking for the young, the laughing, the beautiful wife of old de Broglio. Suddenly I saw her. But as I was trying to get through the crowd to join her, I felt a hand placed upon my shoulder, and that ever-remembered quiet voice within my ear. In a wild anger I took him in a stronghold. Wilson was dressed, as I had expected, like myself, in a rich coat of blue. Around his body was a band of red cloth from which hung a long, sharp sword. A mask of black cloth completely covered his face. "You again!" I cried, my anger growing hotter with each word. "Always you again! You shall not hunt me like this until I die! Come with me now, or I will kill you where you stand!" I pulled him after me into a small room nearby. I threw him against the wall and closed the door. I commanded him to take his sword in his hand. After a moment he took it and stood waiting, ready to fight. The fight was short indeed. I was wild with hate and anger. In my arm I felt the strength of 1,000 men. In a few moments I had forced him back against the wall, and he was in my power. Quickly, wildly, I put my sword's point again and again into his heart. At that moment, I heard that someone was trying to open the door. I hurried to close it firmly and then turned back to my dying enemy. But what human words can tell the surprise, the horror, which filled me at the scene I then saw? The moment in which I had turned to close the door had been long enough, it seemed, for a great change to come at the far end of the room. A large mirror, a looking-glass, or so it seemed to me, now stood where it had not been before. As I walked toward it in terror, I saw my own form, all spotted with blood, its face white, advancing to meet me with a weak and uncertain step. So it appeared, I say, but was not. It was my enemy, it was Wilson, who then stood before me in the pains of death. His mask and coat lay upon the floor. In his dress and in his face there was nothing which was not my own. It was Wilson, but now it was my own voice I heard, as he said, "I have lost, yet from now on you are also dead, dead to the world, dead to heaven, dead to hope. In me you lived, and in my death see by this face which is your own how wholly, how completely you have killed yourself."
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.